Succession number 20362, Reel 3.
Yeah, the commanding officer had ordered all the tanks, C squadron tanks, in a circle with the guns facing outward in the outward direction. And because if the counter attack was to come in too close to us, we were all instructed to all open fire. It didn't come too close to us after about 20 minutes. And he said, okay, we're going to break the circle, I'm going to lead the circle, everybody follow me out, which he did do, and he left the circle, each tank started up, followed out to the circle, and then we found he had taken us to a safe place, and then from then onwards, that was we was okay. We had put our commanding officer, Ronnie Holden, which finished up as DSO NC. Everybody in C squadron had so much faith in the man that you would do anything that he would ask, because you knew that whatever he said was the right thing. Afterwards became the area of Hill 112, and this is the area where the German forces had really had their defensive force there, really to drive, if possible, all the British forces back into the sea. And it was there that we was in the area from the 8th of July until for about 3 weeks until the end of the operation, and that was nothing. There's nothing special about Hill 112. It rises gently from the valley of the Oden River, itself no more than a stream. But Hill 112 became the cornerstone of the German defence in Normandy in the summer of 1944. That is why the Scottish Corridor was blasted south, leaving a trail of desolation, burning farms, burning tanks and burning vehicles. These battles were the baptism of fire of the untried soldiers of the UK command, who for 4 long years had been spectators looking in at the war from the outside. It's a story of 6 weeks of fierce combat, soldiers hanging on grimly to the holes in the ground, and they had managed to win and hold. And it's the story of a cruel battle of fear and bitter memory and courage. Involved in the British side were the 15th Scottish Division, 43rd Wessex Division, 53rd Welsh Division, the 11th Armoured Division, the 4th Armoured Brigade, the 31st Tank Brigade, which 9th Battalion were part of, the 34th Armoured Brigade, and the infantry element of the Guards Armoured Division. Their opponents were the 12th SS Panzer Division, the 21st Panzer Division, the Panzer Lehr Division, the 9th Panzer Division, the 10th Panzer Division, the 9th SS Panzer Division, the 10th SS Division, elements of the 1st SS Adolf Hitler, and the 2nd Panzer Divisions, and the 276th and the 277th Infantry Divisions.
What are your own personal memories from Hill 112?
We'd had one or two casualties from Hill 112. None in 12 Troop. No casualties at all from 12 Troop. But other troops had lost, one or two people had been lost and injured.
Does it stick out in your mind?
Hill 112 does, because it was such a tremendous battle. And the idea of the battle, now we've found out now, was to draw all the German divisions into us to allow the American forces to break through from their sector at the back. And this was really the result, with a lot of casualties. As far as I've read, that particular battle, there were 150 tanks which were destroyed or lost or burned out, and somewhere of the region of 7,000 casualties of infantry and tank forces. And the records say there were more casualties than the actual landings on the British sector on D-Day.
Were you wounded yourself?
No.
What happened after Hill 112?
The breakthrough came where we reached an area at Falaise called the Falaise Gap, and that was where a lot of the German forces were surrounded. Those that broke out started to break out and then retreated right the way back into Belgium, so forth into Holland. So we made the breakthrough. From then onwards, it was driving to contact, and C Squadron, their foot next action was to be at Le Havre, where there was a pocket of resistance at Le Havre, where the German forces had retreated and left a pocket of resistance to try and hold the port at Le Havre as long as they could.
What are your own memories from Le Havre?
It wasn't a tremendous lot, because commanding officer took one troop of tanks, which wasn't my troop, into Le Havre, and the 7th RTR was involved in that as well, Royal Tank Regiment. And it wasn't long before the commander of Le Havre surrendered. So we were based really on the outskirts of Le Havre to be called in if necessary.
Were you called in?
No, we weren't called in.
What are your next memories?
The next memories was we then travelled then into... through Belgium into Essen in Belgium, and from Essen we went into Holland, and our next actions were to be in the Nisbon and the Roosendaal area in Holland, which was about 3 or 4 miles across the Belgian border from Essen. It was from there that we met quite a lot of German resistance. Twelve troop ourselves, we didn't have any casualties, but 15 troop did, and so did 13 troop. They did, and there was. Battles against enemy anti-tank guns against us and infantry, and just at Nisbon we had the infantry with us there, and after the one or two attacks that took place, the infantry went out and they brought, I think it was about 50 prisoners they brought back, and after that we found it was reasonable to start to enter into the town of Roosendaal, where we had the infantry with us, and C Squadron tanks were to go in. They were to be the first that were going to enter into the town. So we entered, We entered into the town, and the first tanks into the town, and the civilian population, well, they you couldn't believe the reactions of them. And we went into the town. The Germans had blown a small bridge in entrance to the town, but luckily enough we carried a Churchill tank, which was a special tank which had a metal bridge on the top of it, and the tank was called for. That tank came up, laid the bridge over this, it was only a narrow stream more or less, and as it laid the bridge on the over the stream, the tanks then went over the bridge into Roosendaal, and there we was met with a mass of Dutch civilians, and they said to us, "Okay, everything's okay. The Germans have moved out about half an hour ago, moved out of the town." So we didn't really face any resistance in the town whatsoever. We went into the town, but the Germans had retreated way back, and we were told to stay in the town and not to go any further than the town, which we did do. We stayed in Roosendaal then for almost a month, because we had to refit, replace the tanks, and get ready for the next operations, which we thought could be into Germany, into southern Holland and Germany.
What were relations like with civilians in Roosendaal?
Oh, it was absolutely, they really, really looked after us, We were, we originally billeted into civilian houses, and it was tremendous. The atmosphere, they really looked after us. At first, when we first went there, 12 and 15 troop, the crews of those, we were billeted into a school. It was a school which wasn't used. All the oak desks were collected and piled downstairs, and we had to go up the very wide concrete stairs right to the top at the attic. And in that attic, it was completely empty. Wooden floors, empty. And there we unrolled our bedding, and at least we had cover. Instead of sleeping in the open for the past weeks, we had cover where we could sleep. And that's where the crews of 15 troop and 12 troop put their beds down. And this was three stories up school, and the attic on top of that. Now the unfortunate thing there, down below there was a fire started, and we thought maybe it was a booby trap that had been left behind by the Germans. We don't know what had happened, but the whole school had caught fire, and we were trapped up in the top. And down below, those that were down below, the Sea Squadron personnel that were down below, they didn't know what to do, because there was no fire engine or anything in the town. They had to do all their utmost to try and get some sort of water, try and put it out, which had caught the oak desks alight, and they were burning quite fiercely. We were up the top there. We looked out the attic windows, which are only small windows, and down below we could see the smoke and that, which the wind was taking down at the base of the school. So we thought to ourselves, what we'll try and do, we'll try and get down the stairs and see if we can go down the stairs out. But we tried to get part of the way down the stairs, but the smoke was too fierce. We had handkerchiefs over our faces, anything that we could. We couldn't get out. So we had to go back up again. In the meantime, they were a bit frantic at the bottom, because we was calling out the people that were up there, you know. The sergeant major down below had gathered three tonner sheets, which were covered to 3 tonner sheets, and he was trying to get everybody to hold like a fire brigade blanket down below, so that people, if necessary, could jump from the top onto the sheet. We started to get to the open the window, and he was going to say, "Okay, ready, jump." The first one jumped. He got badly wounded because no way could they hold a sheet, and he eventually was taken back on a Dakota and died on the way back to England. So immediately, chap that was in our troop, he was the next one to jump. He had broken his leg, and it was decided no way could anybody go that way. We've got to find our own way out. So a few of us went to the back of the school, opened up another window at the top. We tied a series of blankets together, which lucky enough we had up there, and we was going to try and lower ourselves down at the back because the flames were coming from the back through the front of the school. And I was the first one out of the window, lowering myself down the blankets. And I could see below that there was like there was an outhouse at the bottom, a glass outhouse. And I'd got six, seven, 8 feet from the outhouse, and the blankets gave way, and because I just fell. And I went through the glass, and it was just an empty concrete floor. And I hadn't got a bruise, I was perfectly okay. And when I shouted through it was okay, the others had come down and we'd all got out that way. So that was the episode of the start off with Roosendaal. Could I? Yes, we stayed in Roosendaal for about a month, and after that we moved from Roosendaal and went to travel to the south of Holland through Eindhoven towards the German border. We crossed over to the German border, and didn't have any particular action in Germany at all at that stage, because we were more or less going into the border to reorganise ourselves and ready for the next action. But that, after being there for a while, and now we had reached almost mid-December in 44, we were then called away from the German border, and we had to travel then through to Liège, where there had been a breakthrough, the Battle of the Bulge, which was called the Battle of the Bulge, and we had to go through, and we travelled through to Liège, crossed over the river there, and then we went deep into the hilly country, and at an area called Lamont, L-A-M-O-N-T. And from in Lamont, we had to stay there just for in case the counter-attack had come our direction. As it was, the counter-attack never reached us. So we, after a while, when the counter-attack had been stopped, we came back with nothing really to say too much about it. Apart from a lot of snow and very tricky driving for the tanks coming back down the high hills, we came back into Liège and back again into Germany. Not very much happened on the German border there. We came back into Holland from there, and there we had to do a bit more training. We wondered why it was. It was training in the forestry area. But we realised afterwards the reason why it was. So the unit then was moved to, with the infantry, was moved to the Reichswald Forest. And that was part of the Siegfried Line. And the squadron, or the squadron, was ordered to go through the forest, which was about 7 miles deep, and they had to go through the forest, which was mainly pine trees. And what we had to do, we had to knock the trees down as we went through, keep away from the tracks, because they were obviously mined through it being part of the Siegfried Line. And we had to push the trees down and travel like that until we'd reached to the end of the forest. That took a week to 10 days to do that. And what had happened was that some of the tanks had broken down, and I think out of the 50 tanks that had left, I think there was only about 20 tanks that had reached the end. My tank was one that did reach the end. But when we were no more than a mile or two from the far edge of the forest, our commanding officer had found a little clearing, and he'd ordered all the tanks in the clearing in a circle again, because he'd got information that the enemy patrols had entered into the forest and had penetrated past us, so we knew they could come from any direction. So he had ordered all the tanks again in a circle in the clearing. For this operation, I was transferred from 12 Troop into 11 Troop onto the Troop Sergeant's tank, Sergeant Reg Mead. 11 Troop out of the circle, were ordered out of the circle with the request of the infantry, and ordered into a tiny T-junction, T-track, in the forest, no more than 60 or 70 yards away from the main squadron. And there, the 11 Troop went out there, and each tank was on the T-junction, each facing with their backs to one another, looking down each side of the junction. The infantry were dug in on the side of us in the forest. At about 10:30, 11 o'clock, the second in command, Captain Link and Trooper Paget, they came round, because this was in February, they came round with a rum ration, and we all had a rum ration, which was welcome because it warmed us up a little bit. And we got on to the tanks, in which we had each crew of the tank had to spend an hour on duty and 4 hours off, and on guard duty. And each one in the tank had to sit in the commander's position, where the commander stood, and the others were trying to get some rest inside. Each one took their turn, and as the hour was up, they called the next one, who changed over into the commander's position. I came off from guard duty about 11:30 at night, and Reg Mead, the tank commander, Sergeant Tank Commander, he was going to take over from me. He just gave me a push, and he came up from the gunner seat where I would sit. We changed over. He came up into the in the guard duty position. About 11:45, very, very dark in the forest, very quiet, obvious. About 11:45, I heard someone, and I gathered it was someone in a very, very near vicinity, and I gathered they were standing on the tank, And somebody and they had said, "Are you all right, Jock?" in broken English. And when somebody said that, I gathered there was a problem. But before we could do anything about it, there was a machine gun, German machine gun fire, automatic fire. And Regmead had been shot in the back of the head. The first reaction with me sitting, I was the next NCO in charge in the tank. The first reaction would be to pull Regmead inside, because I didn't know exactly what had happened to him then, to close the two hatches in the turret. I pulled him inside and I knew what had happened to him when I pulled him inside, because blood was everywhere. I closed the hatches and at least that stopped a grenade or something being thrown inside the tank. We couldn't fire any guns, we just helpless, we couldn't do anything inside because the infantry that was around us and also our own crews and the tanks were so close together. But then I heard a bit of a thud from outside, and what had happened, and we didn't know this until the following morning, that one of the German infantry had got in front of the tank and fired a bazooka at the tank. And that bazooka had struck the thickest part of the tank, and we didn't see this till daylight the next day. And it had scooped out a big churn of the armament from the front, and lucky enough didn't penetrate the tank, which was an asset to us. Our commanding officer immediately said start up and called us back into the main circle, which we did do. We got back into the circle and joined the circle, and that's where we stayed. It was all over within 2 or 3 minutes. The whole action was over. And we got back and we couldn't do anything until it started getting light. And as it started getting light, I'd got out and had a word with the commanding officer and got back in the tank. And Regmead, he was dead inside. So the commanding officer said to me, Get a couple of lads and lift him out the tank, go through his pockets, get all the information in his pockets and let me have them. And the obvious reason was he had all the information to get information back to his family. And we got him out onto the ground below, I got the information out, give it to the commanding officer, we covered him up, and the commanding officer said, we're all over in a desolate, isolated position here. We can't do anything until we've got to try and get a padre up if we can. And there we stayed for a couple of hours, and suddenly one of our own infantry came through the trees, spoke to our commanding officer and said there was a counteract coming in just the other side of the clearing where we were. The commanding officer knew that I was the gunner in the tank and we'd lost the commander. So he knew that for me to command the tank was impossible to get somebody in to operate the guns. So he said to me, "Stay put, stay where you are, we're going out. As soon as this is finished, we'll come back to where we started." And I knew by what he said, that's what he was going to do, because we relied on him and trusted him. So I stayed back with the rest of the crew, which were completely shaken up. And we stayed there. We could hear the firing taking place. And